So I wanted to start tonight with a story. And this story is set in Johannesburg, South Africa, in the 40s. So apartheid was pretty bad, and it was going to get worse. And imagine a street corner in Black Township. There's a boy standing on the street corner with his mother. And a man passes by and he tips his hat to the woman. And the boy is astonished. This is what the boy wrote years later. He said, "One day I was standing in the street with my mother when a white man in a priest's clothing walked past. As he passed us, he took off his hat to my mother. I couldn't believe my eyes, a white man who greeted a black working class woman." So the boy became interested in the church, the Anglican church, and we know him today as Bishop Desmond Tutu. Bishop Tutu won the 1984 Nobel Peace Prize for working nonviolently against apartheid. And I think that he should have won another Nobel Peace Prize. They don't give them away in twos, unfortunately, but they should have for his work with the Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Because the work that he did really did much to avert a bloodbath of revenge and retribution. He, more than anybody except perhaps Nelson Mandela, helped to at least start some kind of healing process. It's not complete, but things could have been far, far worse. So that Anglican minister walking down the street, tipping his hat, unknowingly and indirectly saved many thousands of lives. And his act of what I call ordinary courtesy was really quite extraordinary. It was probably not popular with his peers. The racism at the time was extreme. So here's a white man walking around tipping his hat to black women. This would have been unheard of. And I'm sure that he found many other ways to outrage his peers as well. But this one it really strikes me just because he's doing what we think of as an ordinary courtesy at a time when that was not at all accepted by as normal by the society at large. When he was walking down the street that day, he wasn't planning on saving thousands of lives. I don't think he even decided consciously to tip his hat. I think his action was probably just reflexive. And that really strikes me as being even more surprising, because he must have consciously developed an attitude of respect, even for people who were made invisible by society. Of course, one of the aspects of this story is that it's about hats, and tipping of the hat is kind of archaic nowadays because, well, for one thing, most men don't wear hats anymore. When you look at, this was the 40s, when you look at old photographs of crowd scenes or movies of crowd scenes outdoors, up until the 60s, men all wore hats. If you see a man without a hat in one of those photographs, you're wondering, did somebody steal that guy's hat? It's unusual. So tipping of hats was one of those sort of gestures of respect. You tipped your hat to a woman, to somebody that you really respected for some reason. There used to be a saying, a tip of the hat to, and then you would name somebody who was deserving of some kind of observation of respect. But this story of the Anglican minister is about the potential power of what we tend to call common decency, which itself is kind of an odd phrase, but common decency. When I heard this story the first time, one of the first things I thought was, could I aspire to be a bit more like that person? Could anybody aspire to be like that? And I think the answer sort of has to be yes. We have to hope that we have the capacity for evil in all of us, and we also have the capacity for good. So this has to do with our intentions, how we cultivate our intentions to act in the world. And I think that's what this Anglican minister did, was that he cultivated, he had an intention that he wanted to manifest in the world, and that he trained himself, in a sense he disciplined himself, to be a decent person. So this brings up the whole thing that we've talked about a lot here at Marin Sangha, about goals and intentions. You sometimes say goals versus intentions. And these words have a lot of overlap, which leads to confusion. They're often used interchangeably, but here we use the words, we have a convention around these words, and we think of goals as being somewhat distant. They're something that we orient ourselves by. They are often ideals. They are often very big, like learn to play the piano, or become a better person, or end cruelty to animals. And some of these goals might be unattainable, but that doesn't mean that they're not worthwhile. There's something that orients us. Intentions are about the immediate present, how we comport ourselves moment by moment. So you can think of goals as being about strategy, and intentions as being about tactics. My goal might be to drive to Tahoe, but my intentions are reflected in how I drive. I slow down here and let somebody change lanes in front of me because I have the intention of being a good driver, and I hope to manifest being a good driver moment to moment when I'm behind the wheel. It doesn't always work that way, but I have this aspiration. Now, goals tend to be tied to outcomes. You know, we want to learn to play the piano. We want to lessen cruelty in the world. So there's outcomes that we want to seek. And as Philip Moffat has said often, we can't own outcomes, because we never know what's going to happen, how things are going to turn out. We can own our intentions. So there's a good example for this. This is a story that I heard many years ago from a doctor, American-trained doctor living in Kathmandu. And he talked about 20 years ago, one of the provinces in India decided to crack down on child labor at carpet factories. And this is a great goal. I mean, these kids work hard in carpet factories. They're not in school. They're harming their eyesight working on not making these little tiny knots in carpets. So why wouldn't you want to help these kids get out of the factory and into school? But somebody also had the great idea of, let's track what happens to these kids after we crack down on this exploitation. So what's interesting is that after these kids were removed from the factories, 30% of them indeed did better. 30% of them ended up back in school or in some other good situation. It's clearly a benefit. About 40% just moved to situations that were similar. They did other kinds of work that were comparable to working in a factory. They might have been working in a store or working on a family farm or something like that, but they were not back in school. And 30% actually did worse. They ended up in places like coal mines, far more dangerous and toxic than a rug factory. And many of them ended up in sex slavery. So for 70% of those kids, their situation did not improve. And for 30% of them, it actually got worse. So the goals and intentions were great here, but the outcome didn't work out so well. So in this situation, skillful means might have been really helpful, and that's something that often comes up in talking about goals and intentions. Skillful means is another aspect of doing things well. So, for instance, skillful means could have helped the situation with shutting down these or getting these kids out of the carpet factories by recognizing that the issue was far more complicated than just shutting down this one form of exploitation. But even skillful means are not enough. I can easily, and I'm sure you could come up with examples too, of situations where you have done things skillfully, you have great intentions, and you have a great goal, and then just something happens that you couldn't have foreseen, and things go wrong. So you can't own the outcome. You can try to be better at achieving a particular outcome, but ultimately you have to let go of that. But we all know of situations where goals and intentions don't align. There are people who work for greater good but do evil in their own vicinity. I remember in the 60s knowing a lot of people who worked for great causes, ending the war, civil rights, and yet they mistreated their own children. But there's yet another gap in this picture. I'm actually going somewhere with all this, by the way. Goals and intentions and skillful means may not be enough for a picture of how we can function more effectively in the world. So I'm thinking of a guy I knew years ago named Carl, who worked at a nonprofit. He was very idealistic, but he was also kind of a grumpy guy, irritable, and he often had a martyr complex, felt that he worked too hard. And one of his jobs was to coordinate the activities of other volunteers at this nonprofit. But what happened is people would come and they'd work for a day or two in this volunteer capacity, but they didn't like working with Carl. Carl annoyed the hell out of them. So they would leave and not come back. So Carl, for all his good intentions, was actually harming the organization that he loved. So he had great goals and great intentions, but he had this bad fundamental attitude, a bad affect, that was just rubbing everybody the wrong way around him. So I think goals and intentions are not the whole picture. And it's also not about skillful means, because if Carl had realized that his attitude was alienating people, then he would have realized that the skillful means was to get his attitude better, to do something about his attitude, to become a happier person or something. So skillful means might have helped him in the long run, but there's still something missing, and that's about the affect itself. So I think attitude is another crucial part of this puzzle. So about 8 or 10 years ago, I read in the newspaper a story of a young man who, living in San Francisco, couple of miles from the Golden Gate Bridge, walked to the Golden Gate Bridge, jumped off it, and died. And when his room was searched, they found a note. And the note said, "I'm going to walk to the Golden Gate Bridge and jump off it. But if anybody smiles to me, at me, or says hello, I'm going to turn around and walk home." So I'd like to think that I'd be the kind of person who would smile at this guy on the street. But would I? I don't know. Would you? Given his mood, would he even notice? We don't know all these things. And let's face it, in San Francisco, there are people on the street that you do not want to make eye contact with. You can just cause all kinds of problems. So skillful means is still important here. But an honest, genuine smile can do a lot in the world. Have you noticed that somebody does you a very small kindness, just things seem brighter and lighter for hours, even the rest of the day? Conversely, somebody is a jerk, driving a car around you, you can still be angry about that days later, thinking about this driver and what he did. So attitude does a lot. So there are Those of you who have read or studied the Satipatthana Sutta, and many of you have, that talks about the four foundations of mindfulness. The third foundation of mindfulness is states of citta. And citta is a word that is often translated as mind. So we often talk about the third foundation as being awareness of mind states. But citta actually means mind and heart, not just mind. So it's about emotional states as well as mental states. And I think if you're going to go that far, you might as well talk about the body as well, because emotional states express themselves in the body as well as the mind. So awareness of the third foundation is really, I think, it's about the state of mind, not about events in the mind, not about thoughts, not about memories. It's about, for want of a better word, mood or attitude. That is, am I cheerful? Am I grumpy? Am I feeling silly? You can learn a lot by just noticing what kind of mood you're in. How does your mind state act as a flavoring to your experience? Or it's like wearing a colored lens. You know, I'm wearing yellow glasses today. Everything looks yellow, and I'm not aware of it. You know, why'd the world turn yellow all of a sudden? Or I noticed a couple of years ago that I was grumpy. I thought everybody was driving really badly that day, and then I realized, no, I'm just in a really crappy mood. And it was a great revelation, because all of a sudden these people were just driving the way they usually are. And I was realized, oh, I better be very careful about what I say to people that I'm close to, because I'm likely to say something stupid and make things worse. So this is a great revelation for me, just starting to notice mind states. Because once you start noticing mind states, you start to notice how your mind states affect how we manifest our practice. They affect how we manifest our practice in the world. How does our attitude help us connect our intentions to our values? This is a crucial link, I think. So how can we change our relationship to our mind state? What can we do about our mind state? Are we completely a victim of it? Can we change it? Is this silly? Is it dangerous? Probably all of the above. So just some observations about what we've gone over so far. Talked about goals and intentions. And I think of goals and intentions about being mental activities. We think about a goal, something that we'd really like. It may be very heartfelt, but they tend to be large abstractions. They tend to be distant. I'd like to learn how to play the piano. I like piano music. I'd really like to understand the circle of fifths better. I'd like to end cruelty in the world. I'm really unhappy about some of the things I see out there. I want to do something about them. And intentions, I think, also are about mental activity. I want to be a better person in the moment. I want to not lose it when I talk to my annoying coworker. So this is still about things that we set mentally. So they're about choices, they're about priorities, they're about volition. So another piece of this is mindfulness. So mindfulness helps us get beyond mental activities into something more immediate. And I'm going to refer to a couple of years ago, I think his name is Jacques Verdun. Well, I'm trying to Frenchify the pronunciation there. All right. So he came here with two ex-convicts. Both of them were men who had spent decades in prison. And one of them, who had been in prison for at least 25 years, maybe 30 years, for homicide, said that the mindfulness practice, the mindfulness meditation, gave him the ability to find the space between anger and violence and the space between craving and using. I love that. I can't think of any more pithy explanation of the practice than that. Finding the space. And, you know, if you want to get a tattoo, get that tattooed somewhere on you. Because it's finding, not getting stuck in our usual patterns on automatic pilot. Not our usual knee-jerk responses. That when we find that space, we actually have the freedom in that moment, when we are in that space, of choosing how we want to act. So mindfulness is what helps us connect our intentions to our highest values by enabling our choice rather than after we do something dumb going, oh, I did that again. So mindfulness is a hugely powerful tool for giving us freedom to align our intentions with our highest values, to actually act the way we want to act rather than just following old programming. This is still around actions, though. In that space, you have the freedom to act or to refrain from acting, to do something good, tip your hat to the woman on the corner, or refrain from responding with a nasty, sarcastic phrase to your loved one. So this is still around actions. And attitude, remember we were talking about attitude. Attitude, mind state, citta, is what is deeper than action. It's more fundamental. It's about one's fundamental affect in any given moment. And all actions are going to spring from that, and choices and our ability to choose are going to spring from that. So that choice, enabled by mindfulness, is more likely to be appropriate if our attitude is good. It's easier to smile or tip your hat if you're feeling generous and kind. It's very hard to smile or tip your hat if you're feeling grumpy. And you have to honor feeling grumpy. It's okay. But you don't want to fake the smile. So back to Bishop Desmond Tutu. I saw a video of him telling a joke recently. It was a really dumb joke. But what was really striking about it, and striking about any video of him, is his effervescence. This man just bubbles with joy. When you think about all that he's seen, all the awful things that he's gone through, it's just astonishing how much joy this man manifests. And I can't help but think of the Dalai Lama in that category as well. So part of this may just be lucky genes, lucky DNA in the brain. But I also think that we can cultivate joy. So there are a number of practices in our lineage that are aligned towards changing our mind state. So one of them is concentration practice. And for one thing, concentration practice stabilizes the mind and it helps us with all these other practices. Mindfulness, for instance, it's very hard to be mindful. It's very hard to notice that moment of freedom between stimulus and response unless your mind is fairly steady and staying with the experience as it's actually arising. Very hard, it can be done, but it's very hard to cultivate mindfulness without the steadiness that concentration practice brings. Another aspect that people don't talk about as much, but I think is important, is that concentration practice can lead to the arising of certain mental states. The names in Pali are piti and sukha. Piti is usually translated as rapture or joy, and sukha as happiness. And piti is usually sort of effervescent, bubbling, energetic. It can be tiring too. And sukha is sweeter, more at ease, restful, peaceful, melting. These are wonderful qualities. And these are things that arise in the beautiful breath. We talked about the beautiful breath earlier. And there are ways to cultivate the beautiful breath. The beautiful breath is a terrific way to cultivate piti and sukha and vice versa. The beautiful breath is also taught by some teachers as a way to develop concentration strong enough to move into jhana, the states of deep meditative absorptions. So piti and sukha are, once one starts to have a feeling that these are cultivatable, one, it empowers you to know that these are experiences not only that you can have, but that sometimes you can cultivate, you can develop. Just knowing about the beautiful breath can change your attitude a lot. Gratitude practice can also be very helpful on its own for just cheering you up. And it's also very good at kickstarting the beautiful breath or some of the other practices around developing piti and sukha. That is a little bit of gratitude, gladness for being alive at this time, for the breath, for knowing love. Even if things are tough sometimes right now, we've known some great things in our lives. Other practices are the Brahma-Vihara practices, metta, or loving-kindness, or I like, one teacher calls it radiant friendliness. I love that. Karuna, or compassion. Mudita, or sympathetic joy, empathetic joy. Joy on behalf of the good fortune of others. And then upekkha, or equanimity. So the great thing about all these practices is that I get to use the word neuroplasticity now, which is very big these days. But it's important. It's really a great concept. Something you've probably heard about already is the violinist's brain. People have done brain scans on concert violinists, and they find that the part of the brain that controls the left hand, which works very hard if you play violin, that part of the brain is much more strongly developed and much bigger and with more connections than other parts of the brain or other the same part of the brain in other people. So it means that we can develop parts of the brain that are associated with kindness, with generosity, with happiness, with joy. It also means, conversely, that we can develop parts of the brain associated with anger. You probably all know people who do this. We all know Republican candidates who do this. So this works both ways, but at least we know, if we know what direction we want to go in, that we actually have this capacity. We can develop a part of our mind the way we might develop a muscle. With a muscle, you lift a weight. You stress out that muscle. You go to the edge of that muscle's capability, and the capability grows. So with compassion, you go to the edge of your compassion. You strengthen the compassion. Next time, or maybe it takes years, there's more capacity for compassion. But an important thing here is to acknowledge that you can change your mind state. You can change your default mind state. Doesn't mean it's always going to be that way. It just means that your set point may shift a little bit. What it means is that you're not your story. So often we have an outlook on life and it's because of bad things that happen to us or bad situations around us. We may not be able to control those situations. And the situations may really have a negative effect on us, but we can still change such that within the range of movement that's open to us, we can still move in a direction that we want. So you can make radiant friendliness more available as your default setting, as where you're starting from. And not all the time, never perfectly, but just a little bit. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time, and a lot of people in this room know how often I have lost it and said things inappropriately or done things that I should not have done. So this process is never complete. You're never going to be a perfect person. But you can be a better person. Anyway, all of these qualities and others, the Brahma Viharas, the meditation practices of various flavors, can make you a happier person. And, of course, there are pitfalls. One of them is self-congratulation. Oh, I'm a generous person. I love that about myself. End up patting yourself on the back for all your fine qualities that you've developed. It's so easy to be holier than thou, or in the meditation community, more mindful than thou. Another thing to watch out for is, I think, nicely summed up in the near enemies of the Brahma Viharas. Most of you already know that the Brahma Viharas, the four great qualities of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity, all have what's called far enemies and near enemies. The far enemies are obvious. I think the far enemy of loving kindness is hatred. I was going to try to bring one of my old handouts with me, and I forgot to. But it's the near enemies that are sometimes a lot more interesting than the far enemies, because the far enemies tend to be obvious. Like the far enemy of equanimity is agitation. That makes sense. But the near enemy of, say, compassion is pity. Now, those words are very similar. You might find them side by side in a thesaurus. So what is the difference? The connotation is a little subtle, I think. But to me, what pity implies is, I'm so glad that's not happening to me. Or there's a little bit of a superiority, like you have pity on somebody who is less fortunate than yourself. Compassion is called by some the heart's quiver. It's like, oh yeah, it's like that. I see that. And pity has much more strongly an element of selfing. And usually when you feel compassion, unless you're enlightened, it's going to be a mix of the two, really. But how strong that natural compassion is something that you can develop. The pity has more self in it. It's more about me than it is about the person for whom I'm ostensibly feeling compassion. Another one is apathy is a near enemy of equanimity. So, for instance, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, I ended up in the hospital with an intestinal problem. I was there for 2 nights. So I don't recommend that. I know it sounds glamorous and luxurious, but it's not all it's cracked up to be. And if you've ever had an intestinal problem, one of the things you know happens is you become very, very apathetic. So somebody around you might be very agitated and worried about you and think, oh, Bill is really being very equanimous about this. No, I wasn't being equanimous about it. I was being completely apathetic. And part of that is that you get very lethargic when you're having intestinal problems like that. So apathy versus equanimity. That was an easy one for me. I knew equanimity was not happening for me. And it's not a Brahma Vihara, but I like to think of generosity as being as good as one. And real generosity isn't selfish. Think about that for a minute. I mean, it's true on several levels. I mean, obviously you're giving something, but you're not being generous in order, if it's real generosity, you're not doing it in order to feel good or to look good. And so many of us do generosity in order to look good to ourselves and to others. So real generosity is just open and unselfish. So I think the near enemies, what's true of all of the Brahma Viharas near enemies, is that there's a selfish aspect of it. Very subtle sometimes, but it's there. It's more self-absorbed or self-centered than it is about the natural aspects of the quality itself. So another big pitfall, I think, for cultivating these qualities, for cultivating these positive mind states, is faking it. Putting on a happy face and deluding others and yourself. And we've all know people like that. We've probably done it ourselves, especially visiting relatives, or you've just been laid off and you don't want people to know how devastated you feel. And that might be appropriate in some places, but just to recognize that faking happiness is not going to make you happy. Could make things worse. Now, I've got one caveat there that occurs to me. And that is, when you're meditating, here's a trick. Here's a little bit of practicum. And I didn't do it in the guided sit. And that is that if you're trying to cultivate the beautiful breath or just happiness or metta, something that can really help, really improve your attitude and help concentration as well, is put a little smile on your lips. It sounds really silly, but in fact, neurophysiologists who have done brain scans on people who do this as part of their meditation practice see that the parts of the brain associated with happiness light up more. It actually has sort of a reverse engineering effect on your mind. So it's worth trying. I don't know if it works for everybody, but I have found, I have to admit, grudgingly, that it does work for me. So putting on a smile can sometimes help, but you really have to watch this whole thing about faking it to make yourself look like the kind of person that you really like to be. So something I've already touched on a little bit is that states of mind are contagious. Somebody is nasty to you, you're in a bad mood for the rest of the day. Somebody shows you some small kindness, you might be in a good mood or just a slightly better mood for the whole day. Some of this has been neurophysically verified. And after all, we are social animals. There are, I forget what they call the brain cells that are sort of sympathetically fire with other mirror neurons. Thank you. Mirror neurons that fire in sympathy or in synchronization with what's going on with other people. So our attitude is going to have a big effect on the people around us. It's got a ripple effect. And it's as simple as ordinary courtesy, or personal respect, or common decency. And tipping your hat. And perhaps changing a life. Maybe changing your own life. So we have enough time for some comments, questions, rants, ramblings, hysterical.
Well, I was interested in the part about faking happiness based on an experience I just had. I'm coming fresh back from a month in Florida dealing with my elderly sick mother. And I think I see a dividing line where the faking of happiness, when it's used to, in New Age terms, what they call creating it, what you want, believing that you can create a material outcome by behaving in a certain way and making it happen. So that, I see that as kind of a false step, whereas for people who are in a lot of suffering and misery, even if that's because of their own mental problems, that they can, developing the habit of thinking happiness can actually, to some degree, ease that suffering and misery, particularly along the right intention.
So what Arlette was saying, in case you couldn't hear her, was that it generally doesn't work if you're trying to act happy in order to form the outcome, in order to manipulate the universe in your favor. Is that a fair?
Yes.
But on the other hand, faking happiness to some extent can actually make you happier within certain constraints.
Well, or at least reduce the suffering.
Reduce the suffering,
and
right.
Misery. And it can be physical suffering that is enhanced by habits of mind that are negative and angry.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you are able to learn some habits of mind that are more toward the positive, which I would call faking happiness,
mm-hmm.
Then it really can help ease your pain.
Right, and I think there's a gray area here between easing one's suffering by, I don't want to say acting happy, because that's not quite right, but that there's some behaviors can help cultivate more happiness or less suffering. It's dangerous because it is a gray area. We've all met people who smile a lot, and yet everyone around them is kind of edgy, because it just, there's something wrong about it. So I think sometimes a little bit of self-delusion is not a bad thing, but a lot of self-delusion is dangerous. Deborah?
So my thoughts are not clear here, but I feel compelled to say something about this. There's a 12-step, it's not about faking happiness in a bad way to fool people or to trick people necessarily, although there may be people doing that. There's a 12-step expression called fake it till you make it. And I think how I always interpreted that is kind of what you were talking about in that gap between anger and violence. It's going back to heart intention and mental intentions, it's practicing new behavior. Even though I know for myself sometimes, just this is a stupid example, but yesterday it seemed like I could not get out of the kitchen. And at some point I said, I do not want to wash any more of these damn dishes, but I'm going to because I need to, because blah, blah, blah. And I did it. And as I was doing the activity, it shifted my energy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just reading something by Linda Graham, who's a psychotherapist and a student of Rick Hansen's and also teaches Dharma, just about this exact thing of changing your body energy, just the Qigong we do here. And I know for myself that if I just get up and shake around or dance around, it can shift my pain level, it can shift my mental attitude. So I just wanted to put a plug in for that.
Thanks for bringing that up. Wendy Palmer talks about this a lot as well, mm-hmm. that the way we move our body and hold our body has a tremendous effect on us neurologically. And so very often, and I think, and I really didn't touch on this and should have, getting to know what your mental state is often about looking in the body, not in your mind. Because your mind will fool you. Your mind will delude you all the time. You can't trust that mind. It's sneaky. But your body doesn't lie to you. And so conversely, often doing something with your body can really shift the attitude. So I don't know as much about the 12-step thing. I think some of that is just, if you have a habit of going out and robbing banks, it's a good idea not to. Even if that means faking it, because you're really compelled to rob banks. Okay, that's an extreme example, but you're compelled to do something quite negative. You might be faking it for a while, but in some ways, you really have to refrain from something that's really doing harm. So I think sort of what I was focusing on tonight was, you know, more subtle shifts, sort of grad student approaches, perhaps.
More subtle than Robin Banks?
No, not at all. I think she was talking about the physical. Wow, a lot. Okay, Dale.
Real quick question. You mentioned two of the near enemies of two of the Brahma Viharas, mm-hmm. passion and equanimity, but didn't mention the other two, and I was just curious what those were.
I did not. And as I said, I did not bring my handout with me. I was in a hurry, and so I actually don't remember what the near enemies of the others are. Art, do you remember the near enemies?
Near enemy of metta would be attachment.
Oh, for sympathetic joy, so for metta, it's the word, I think, is attachment, and it usually means, like, really getting stuck on something. For sympathetic joy, one teacher, the actual word translates to...
giddiness.
Right, like a giddiness, but there's another even more colorful word that's often used, very Victorian sounding, but I don't remember what it is. But what I've heard from one teacher is that the near enemy of sympathetic joy is like vicarious joy. It's like you start thinking, oh, so-and-so got a nice job. Wow, that's great. I'd feel great if that happened to me. Maybe you can pay me back that $20 he owes me. You start taking vicarious pleasure from it, like imagining yourself in that position. Oh, so-and-so won the lottery. Wow, that would be great. Rather than just happy for the good fortune of that person.
I think maybe Warriors fans sometimes go a little beyond Mudita.
So, Patty?
I just want to share a practice that I started very recently. I've had a gratitude practice for years, and I have a gratitude partner, and every week we exchange letters of gratitude, and it's a lovely practice. She doesn't use email, so I was forced to do handwriting letters. But I get real mail once a week, which in and of itself is for something to be grateful for. But lately, when someone performs an act of kindness, instead of just saying thank you, I say out loud, that was very kind. And it reinforces my sense of the kindness. Sometimes 10 times in a day, I find myself saying that was very kind, thank you. Thank you for your kindness, or that was so kind. And I learned it from my daughter-in-law's mother, who only spoke Spanish, but she always said, muy amable, very nice, very nice. And I realized it's much nicer than thank you. It's like an enhancement from thank you, and it lifts my spirits. And it reminds me how much kindness is in the world. And I'm going through a very tender time now with the loss of a lot of people I love. Two people I love have died very recently. And I am astounded at the kindness that is coming out of the woodwork from people who knew them and people who are helping me with the estate things. There's just so much kindness out there. When we acknowledge it verbally by saying, thank you, that was so kind, it's soothing. It's like reminding me with every thank you that there's kindness out there.
That is a wonderful practice. I like that, and I really like the compassion letters, handwritten compassion letters.
Gratitude
letters. So, did everybody hear that?
Mm-hmm.
All right, great. Barbara?
Well, I was thinking about the whole fake it till you make it bit. And I think there's an interesting distinction between trying to delude yourself that you're happy, but between that and acting as if you were happy. In other words, I'm mindful that I'm not happy, but I'll act, I'll tip my hat to this person. I'll smile at someone and say, oh, I won't be faking it to myself, but I'll be, again, practicing the way Deborah was talking about, using your body energy that way. And I found that sometimes helpful.
I like that. And I think an aspect of that is just, you know, behaving yourself in the world. You might not feel like going out and being nice, but at least you're not going to go out and be a jerk. So...
me and what you just said there, Barbara, was that you're not deluded.
Right, you're not deluded.
You're aware that it's not quite there, but it's kind of like your intention. Yeah. You have an intention to work towards happiness.
Right. Katie?
I wanted to talk just a little bit about the, when you talked about putting the smile on your face and how it changed your body. I saw a TED talk a few days ago just about that very thing, about changing your body position can change your mood and frame of mind. So, of course, she'd done all this research and tested all these people, but it was quite remarkable the results they had. They had people who were having job interviews, and so they tried, you know, different positions, and, you know, it made a huge difference in testing and job interview and how the people felt, how much power they felt they had.
Mm-hmm.
And it was physical, just like Wendy Palmer says, dignity. It changed their mood, and I think that's interesting.
I think Wendy Palmer is coming back sometime this year, and if anybody here hasn't heard her speak, it's really a surprising and different approach, and I really recommend
conscious
it very strongly.
Conscious embodiment.
Conscious embodiment.